pews to Genesis chapter 40. For a passage this morning from Joseph's story. Some time after this, when Joseph had been placed in jail, the cupbearer of the king of Egypt and his baker offended their lord, the king of Egypt. Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the cupbearer and the chief baker, and he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, in the prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he waited on them, and they continued for some time in custody. One night, they both dreamed. The cupbearer and the baker of the king, who were confined in the prison, each his own dream, and each dream with his own meaning. When Joseph came to them in the morning, he saw that they were troubled. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with them in custody in his master's house, "Why are your faces downcast today?" And they said to him, "We have had dreams, and there is no one to interpret them." And Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me." And skip all the way down to the very end passage of this chapter, verse 23. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but instead forgot him. Disappointment, desperation, discouragement. I would imagine that while we are diverse in ages and various life circumstances, that all of us, from our youngest elementary school student to our oldest senior adult, that every one of us has experienced one, two, or maybe even all three of these words in your life. Joseph was very familiar with all three. Can you imagine the disappointment that he had in his brothers as he watches them while he is being taken off with the merchants in a slave caravan to Egypt? Think about the desolation that begins to fill his stomach with stress as he does the right thing and runs from Potiphar's wife, only to begin to hear her screaming as she holds his cloak in his hands, knowing that it really is not good. You know, in the course of attempting to live out his dream, Joseph has had to face obstacle after obstacle. Last week we discovered in chapter 39 that as Joseph faced these obstacles, we found that, well, the Spirit of God was with him, and that God continued to help make him a success, continued to bless Joseph as he faced those different obstacles. When he goes into slavery, he rises to the top of the servants in Potiphar's house. When he goes into jail, he rises to become dependable and trusted, and as the manager of the other prisoners that are gathered there. And by the time we arrive here in chapter 40, the narrative has prepared us to sort of expect that same sort of thing. That while he faces obstacles, we know that, well, it's going to turn out fine for Joseph. And maybe even Joseph has come to expect the same thing. But instead, chapter 40 brings Joseph into a wasteland, into a valley of the unknown, where there is no indication that he will ever get out. You see, it's been several years now since Joseph arrived in this dungeon. Several years since he was out free, if you could call it that, as a slave in Potiphar's house. And while he has been placed in charge of these other prisoners, he's still in prison. It's still a long way away from when he was Jacob's favorite son. And he was wearing that coat of many colors wherever he would go, where he got where he wanted, where he knew he could do no wrong in his father's eyes. And it's nowhere close to that dream that he had, where he would rise to royal authority and there would be people who would bow to him. His dream seems as far away now than it ever has. But into this setting arrive two very important prisoners. You see, they are from Pharaoh's kitchen. And some way or another, both have offended Pharaoh. And so while Pharaoh is deciding what he wants to do with these two important people of his court, he places them in custody in the house of the captain of the guards of the jail. And Joseph, being the kind of guy that you could depend on, is placed in the care of these two very important prisoners. One of them is the cupbearer to the king. The other is the chief baker. And both of these are vital roles because within all of the ancient world, the person who is the king is Pharaoh. And these two people have access, direct access to the king. So one morning, Joseph decides that he's going to see what's going on with these two prisoners. So as he arrives to bring them their food, to care for them, to see what kind of needs they would have for the day, he notices that both of them have very troubled looks on their faces. And so he asks them, "Well, what's going on? Why so downcast a face?" And both of them reply, "Well, you see, we both have had dreams, but there's no one to interpret them." Now, by this point, we know that Joseph has experience with dreams. It's dreams that got him into this challenge in the very first place. But his dream of royal authority that began way back in Palestine is a long way from being able to interpret dreams. And so far, until Joseph's life, we have not seen that type of gift in his life. And even Joseph recognizes that it is a very unique spiritual gift to interpret these dreams. And so he said, "Don't you know that interpretation belongs to God?" But then Joseph recognizes that God has gifted him in another way. He tells the two prisoners, "Please tell me your dreams." In a way, Joseph is letting us know what he already knows, is that he has been gifted by God for dream interpretation. But not only is that the only gift, Joseph, remember, comes from this tribal background. The only experience he has in the royal courts of the Egyptian Empire is what he had as he managed Potiphar's house. But there is a unique gift that Joseph has, and that is he has this perception to understand the courtly life. And so as he begins to ask these two very important officials about their dreams, not only is he recognizing that he has a gift of God to be able to interpret them, but he also has this indescribable intuition to know how life is played out in the courts. And so he says, "Tell me your dreams." And the cupbearer does. He tells Joseph about his dream, that about seeing a vine and there are three branches, and he also sees the Pharaoh's cup. And Joseph quickly gives him the interpretation. He says, "Within 3 days, Pharaoh will restore you to your office." But then we see in verses 14 and 15, Joseph's true motives and his own desperation. You see, so far Joseph hasn't spoken any about this situation that he has been in. But here we begin to hear him struggling for a way out. He says to the cupbearer, "When all goes well with you, remember me and show me kindness." That word kindness, once again, is that Hebrew word I keep mentioning because I want you to know it so well. That word hesed. The same word that we, verse 39, we see that God has already shown Joseph. "But show me kindness when all goes well. Mention me to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison." You can almost hear the desolation, the desperation of wanting to finally get away from where he is. You can almost hear him say, "I was forcibly removed from the land of the Hebrews, and even here, I have not done anything wrong to be in this dungeon." With as much control, desperation that he can manage, Joseph is seeking a way out of this prison. And we know that God's presence is already with him. We know that God has already blessed him. But Joseph is still desperate to get out. Well, the chief baker hears this dream of the cupbearer, and he wants a similar type of interpretation. But when Joseph tells him, he's not so happy with it. You see, instead of his dream being about restoration, instead, the baker hears that he will be executed. What does it feel like to walk in the valley of disappointment and desperation and discouragement? We see it in Joseph. For while all of his dreams, interpretations come exactly true, so that on the third day there's a great celebration for the Pharaoh's birthday, and he calls both of these two men out. And one, the cupbearer, is restored to his position, and the other is executed. We come down to verse 23. The chief cupbearer, however, once he is placed back into his old position and he now has Pharaoh's ear, Scripture says, did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. There is no end in sight for Joseph. You see, rather than giving us an example of how Joseph's story is another way of leading to success, chapter 40 gives us a picture of Joseph in the valley of disappointment and discouragement. And while we, as the readers of the story, the audience, know how Joseph's story will end, Joseph does not. He only knows of his experience at the depth of the Egyptian prison, and that no one else knows that he is there. He truly is forgotten by his father, by his brothers, by Potiphar, and now by his only other outlet to the outside world, the cupbearer. Discouragement, disappointment, desperation. Can you relate to those experiences in Joseph's life? Disappointment when the letter arrives saying, "Thank you for sending your resume, but we really are looking for a different kind of candidate." Discouragement when we see that other less qualified people moving forward in their careers and we feel stuck in ours, if we even have one these days. Desperation for the house to sell or the bid to be chosen or for the loan to go through when foreclosure or bankruptcy seems to be creeping on our doorstep. Disappointment and tears when the pregnancy tests continue to say negative. And we've been trying for years. Disappointment When we look back on our lives and see our past mistakes, our failures, or sins. Discouragement when we see the decisions that our children, our grandchildren are making, and we know that it does not lead to a path that is righteous. Disappointment in our own parents because they did not give us the encouragement or the spiritual backing that we needed for a life of faith. Desperation to get our children or our parents or other family members back in the church because we know what it requires of their lives. This week I listened to the disappointment and discouragement and desperation of a blogger friend of mine who's also a pastor. When he discovered that his teenage daughter was pregnant, he wrote these words about that one day, the first day when they heard. It says, "Hours later, when I was the only one awake, Shelby, his daughter, was frightened and overwhelmed, but unable to comprehend the fullness of what all this was going to mean for her life. But she still managed to fall asleep. Jeannie, his wife, exhausted from crying and grief, finally slept as well. And I was left alone and wide awake. On that night, every dark voice from my past came back to haunt me. And if I managed to wrestle one negative, fearful thought to the ground, 10 others were waiting to take its place." He was walking through the valley of discouragement, desperation, and disappointment. Noble Doss still walks through that valley. You see, he dropped the ball. Literally, just one ball, one pass, one mistake way back in 1941. And he's still haunted by it. He says, "I cost us the national championship." You see, the University of Texas football team was ranked number one in the nation that year. And they were hoping for an undefeated season and a berth to the Rose Bowl when they came to play their conference rival, Baylor University. And so with a 7-0 lead in the third quarter, the Longhorn quarterback launched a deep pass to a wide open Doss. "The only thing I had between me and the goal line," Doss said later, "was 20 yards of grass." The throw was on target. Longhorn fans throughout the stadium rose to their feet, and the sure-handed Doss spotted the ball and reached out, only to have the ball slip through his fingers. Baylor came back and rallied in the fourth quarter with only seconds to play, tying the game. And Texas lost their top ranking and consequently their chance for the Rose Bowl and a national championship. Doss admits, "I think about that play every day." It's not that he lacks other memories. He's happily married for over 60 years. He's a father, a grandfather. He served in the Navy during World War II. He appeared on the cover of Life magazine with his Texas college mates. He intercepted 17 passes during his collegiate career, which was a university record. He went on to win 2 NFL titles with the Philadelphia Eagles. He's included in the Texas Hall of Fame for high school football players in the Longhorn Hall of Fame. And most fans will remember all the plays that Doss made and the passes that he caught. But Doss only remembers the one that he missed. Once upon meeting a new Longhorn head coach, Doss told him about bobbling that ball. It had been over 50 years since the game, but he still wept as he spoke. He never quite made it out of that valley of disappointment. Jeff Mannion, in his book called The Land Between, writes this about what disappointment and the valley of disappointment can do in our lives. Since when we move into the valley of disappointment, our heart drifts toward complaint as if by a gravitational pull. After all, complaint seems a reasonable response to a sequence of disappointing events. Generally, you don't have to extend an invitation for a complaint to show up. In fact, it arrives as an unexpected guest. You return home from yet another frustrating day to discover that complaint has moved into your guest room, unpacked its luggage, started a load of laundry, and rooting around now in the fridge. Even as you seek to dislodge complaint, as you move its bags to the curb and change its locks, it still crawls back through the guest room window. You see, complaint resists eviction. And before we know it, complaint feels right at home, and it feels as familiar as anything else with our lives. With every struggle, we become the Israelites murmuring in the desert. We miss the faith lessons. God desires to prepare us and build things into us, but we are hunkered down into our response of complaint. You see, we need to wake up and notice what is happening. How do we evict the spirit of complaint from our lives? It's been said that bad movement pushes out good movement, and good movement pushes out bad. If we can discourage complaint's residency in our lives, we can do it by inviting another guest to occupy our guest room and to move in with us. And that new guest is trust. When we choose to trust in the face of disappointment, discouragement, and desperation, complaint has less space to maneuver. While attempting to unpack for an extended stay, it discovers that trust has already taken all the drawers in the guest room and already occupies the empty seat at the table. Trust evicts complaint. Because trust and complaint are incompatible roommates. One inevitably pushes out the other. Think back about Joseph. He's stuck in this prison in Egypt. He's disappointed in the fact that no one remembers where he is. And most don't even know that he's there. I would imagine that Joseph knew the temptation of complaint. And maybe it had even attempted to make residency many times in his life. But Joseph also knew God's presence. He had already experienced God's blessings. And in spite of the fact that he is discouraged and disappointed and disillusioned, he still trusted in God. You know, if we could see our whole lives like we see Joseph's life throughout the narrative in Genesis, where we could look and we could skip past chapter 40 and get on to chapter 41, trusting in God would be easy. Because we could easily flip through our lives and say, oh, I know this is a hard time, but God has his other stuff on ahead of me. So I can just trust in him now because I know it's going to be okay in the future. But that's not how trust works, is it? Trust is when we don't know the future. Trust is we don't know how it's all going to end up. Trust is when we don't know whether there's an end to this valley or not. But we still believe that God wants the best for us. And so we place our trust in God's care. And we trust that God knows our story and that we are a part of God's story. And that because of that, we can depend on Him. You see, for us to see our dreams realized, we must move from complaint to trust. We all have experienced desperation, discouragement, and disappointment. Some of us are walking in that valley today. And we have two choices: complaint or trust. Which choice will you make? You know, over the past several weeks, as we've begun to dare ourselves to dream again, each week I've asked you to begin to reflect on God's dreams for your life. And I've given you a different question every Sunday for you simply to chew on, reflect on this day and throughout the course of the week. I've put all three of the questions, two of them from last couple of weeks and one from today, on your sermon guide. One of them is still this: what is God's dream for your life? One from last week is this: where has your dream been hijacked? And this week, as the instrumentalists come and play, and as we simply reflect on our scripture, on God's place in our lives this week, I ask you to reflect on this. What is one thing that I can do this week to trust in God? What is one step of faith I can make this week to invite trust in my life? You see, a complaint will never leave until we begin to invite trust back into our lives. And so as Bobby plays from our hymn of decision, which is hymn number 300, let me invite you to simply listen to God's movement in your story. And if you need to write some stuff down, do it. But allow God to begin to move in your life and in your dreams, and respond when necessary.